That's session number 12524, and this is Reel 2.
Commodore Brown Reel 2.
Right. Yes, I was saying Johnny Walker had been a flight commander in Number 1 Squadron. And then at the end of the Battle of France, the survivors of Number 1 Squadron came home and, in fact, formed the staff of Number 11 Group Fighter Pool, which eventually became a fighter operational training unit at Aston Down, where they could impart their operational experience to the new pilots coming from the flying training schools. And that's where I first met Johnny, who by that time was a squadron leader, and a very respected and extremely well-liked man. And so I was delighted to arrive at 253 Squadron and find that he was the squadron commander. One of the most striking features, I think, about the fighter squadrons in those days was they were made up of a hodgepodge of people. In order to provide reinforcements, or pilot reinforcements to fighter command at the critical stage, people were being transferred from all sorts of other roles. So, for example, one of the two flight commanders had been an ex-fleet air arm pilot. And I think he'd been flying Walrus seaplanes. And he was one flight commander. The other flight commander was a very colourful chap called Duke Woolley, who had been a very successful night fighter pilot on Blenheims and had scored one of the very early successes in a Blenheim at night with an early AI set. But he'd been frustrated, I think, wandering around the pitch black sky looking for Germans he couldn't find, and he got himself transferred onto Hurricanes. And then, in addition to the people from different roles within the Royal Air Force, of course, all the squadrons in those days were made up with pilots that had escaped from various parts of Europe. So they were all, in a way, a sort of a foreign legion. In 253 Squadron, we had two Czechs, a Pole, and two free Frenchmen. And only recently arrived from Europe. Some of them didn't speak English at all, but they'd picked up the standard RT phrases and so on. But sometimes in the air, when they were excited, they'd start talking to one another in their own language. It was absolutely chaotic. So it really was a very interesting and mixed bunch of people, and all wearing their own uniforms in those days. And they'd all had an interesting history. The Czechs had escaped through southern Europe, initially had joined the French Army de l'Air, but were nominally on the strength of the French Foreign Legion. And one of them, particularly a chap called Vicky Suker, a sergeant pilot, had shot down quite a fair number of Germans during the Battle of France, flying with the French Air Force. And so he had the Croix de Guerre and Legion of Honour, and very unusual for a chap of that rank. The other interesting pilot was a very smart French lieutenant commander from the French Navy called de Sidivo, who came from a fairly aristocratic a French family. Who used to wear the most gorgeous French uniform, all covered in gold braid. And he did well during the war, and eventually finished up as an admiral in the French Navy. In fact, he was the commander-in-chief of the French Mediterranean Fleet before he retired. So it really was a mixture of all sorts of interesting people from different backgrounds. And, of course, for a young man of 18, it was all very impressionable.
What kind of a welcome did they give you? Was it a warm one? Or
yes.
Were
yes. Because, as you know, only the... there were minimum standards of RAF discipline maintained. Because in that situation over the previous few months, there hadn't really been any time for the niceties of Air Force life. For example, people wore flying clothing in the mess because they had to. They never knew when they were going to be suddenly brought to readiness. And so things were a bit relaxed. But also, though, as a tremendous sort of friendly atmosphere had developed. And there was a minimum of formality in the relationship, say, between the squadron and flight commanders on the one hand and the pilots on the other. And it was very much an operational team. And in fact, it was a bit of a shock. In January 1941, when the squadron was moved from Kenley on the way up to Orkney, and we stayed at Leconfield for a month, and the station commander at Leconfield and the station warrant officer had a lot of old-fashioned ideas about the way people in the Air Force should behave. And so there was an instant return to Air Force discipline with parades and inspections and haircuts and so on, which was a bit hard to take after the relaxed atmosphere one had been in for the few months previously.
But did people accept it?
Oh, yes, of course. It's probably good for the soul anyway.
Can you describe any specific incidents operating from Kenley that stick out in your mind from operations?
I don't think anything that would really be of outstanding interest. Earlier on I'd mentioned the sort of lack of a realistic view of tactics.
Yes.
And fighter command, to begin with, was using the old fighter command attack drills of trying to attack an enemy in formations of three fighters. Well, at a time when the Germans were flying in finger fours, which they'd learned to do in Spain. That had been overcome, but fighter command had adopted a system of weavers, with the squadron flying in open combat formation, and the chap at the back weaving backwards and forwards across the tail end of the formation to make certain they weren't surprised or bounced from the rear. That was all right up to a point. But normally, the chap at the tail end was one of the most inexperienced pilots. So he'd be the chap, under the conditions of high-flying combat, fighter to fighter, that was usually the first one to be picked off. And it wasn't till later on into 1941, and I think probably in Douglas Bader's wing at Tangmere, that the system of finger fours without the weavers was finally adopted, and of course proved to be much more effective.
Was this a happy time for you at Kenley?
Yes. Yes. It was all a happy time, I think. Yes, it was.
What was the best aspect of it for you?
Well, really, one was engaged in operational flying with all the sort of excitement and interest of that, without quite the same risks and hazards that people had experienced, you know, only a few weeks before. And this was really, I think, during the lull between the Battle of Britain, which was really tailed off by the German high fighter sweeps, between that phase and then Fighter Command itself going over to the offensive over the French coast and northern Belgium. By that time, Sholto Douglas had become the commander-in-chief, and Lord Trenchard, who'd been the advocate, of course, of the offensive philosophy on the Western Front in the First World War, and which really had cost the Royal Flying Corps a lot of pilots. In other words, one of the principles of air power was always to maintain the offensive, to keep the initiative. And he suggested to Sholto Douglas that it's time Fighter Command started, I think his words were, to lean forward into France, with a view, really, to regaining the initiative. And it proved, I think, in the end, to be rather a frustrating and a costly business in the long term. One of the main purposes, particularly from middle of 1941 onwards, was to pin down German fighter forces in the west and keep them away from the Russian front. And I think that only partially succeeded. The Germans maintained a small but very effective force of fighters in the west. I can't remember how many now, probably no more than 200 or 300. And it certainly, it pinned those down. They found, I think, during the early days of the offensive, that the Germans wouldn't react strongly against purely fighter formations. So in order to tempt them into combat, Bomber Command was brought in, mainly with the Blenheims of two group, small formations of Blenheims, really liked as bait, and then they were replaced by Bostons. But at one time in 1940-41 with Stirlings, that really started to take a beating. I mean, they were being shot down in ones and twos, and I don't think Bomber Command were very keen on being the bait for Fighter Command. My main experience of combat really was during those offensive fighter phases. And it was a very similar situation to that which existed at the back end of 1940 in the UK. In other words, it was frustrating. It was high-flying, fighter against fighter, with the Germans, understandably, I think, being unwilling to stop and mix it. So there were fleeting combat opportunities.
Where were you operating from when you were doing this?
Well, I stayed with 253 Squadron for about another year. We went to Orkney for the defence of Scarpa Flow, where it was all convoy patrols and trying to intercept the German maritime reconnaissance and weather reconnaissance aircraft operating on a shuttle between Norway and northern France. We then became a Cat's Eye Night Fighter Squadron and moved down to the Midlands. And at the end of 1941, I then moved to another squadron, 616, South Yorkshire Auxiliary Squadron, which was equipped with Spitfires. And we were based at Wittering when the great Basil Embry was the station commander. And every bright spring morning, we get up early and we fly down to Westmoreland for the day, refuel, do two fighter sweeps from Westmoreland, and then fly back to Wittering in the evening. In other words, the 12 group used to put up a couple of wings to support the 11 group fighter operations.
How did you like the Spitfire in comparison?
Well, it was a marvellous aeroplane in comparison with the Hurricane. It was, you know, it was really in a different era.
Can you...
Although one has to say that, you know, the way these sort of phases go, that I went from the Hurricane to the Spitfire 5B, which was a far superior aeroplane to the Hurricane in performance and altitude. But of course, at that time, the Germans had introduced the Focke-Wulf 190 in force over France, which in its turn was a far superior aeroplane to the Spitfire 5B. And in fact, it had a distinct advantage until, you know, the pendulum went back again and the squadrons got the Spitfire Mark 9, which in itself was a superior aeroplane to the Focke-Wulf 190. But I think in the Spitfire 5B, we were certainly fighting at a disadvantage against Focke-Wulf 190.
Can you tell me about Basil Embry and the leadership he gave?
Well, yes. Basil was a great inspiration to everyone. He was an aggressive chap, always led from the front, no nonsense, mixed with all the pilots, knew everyone. And I owe him really an especial debt of gratitude, because during that time I'd been shot up and hit in the face and lost my right eye. And in hospital, rather, you know, I wouldn't say felt sorry for myself, but rather wondering what I was going to do. And I got a message to say that before I went on sick leave, I was to go and report to the station commander at Wittering, which I did. And he just bluntly said to me, "Do you want to go back on flying?" And I said, "Yes, sir." So he said, "Well, you go and have your sick leave." And 2 weeks later, I was flying with the Spitfire Squadron again. Having had that breakthrough, I then re-established myself. We had all sorts of problems from higher authority saying, "Well, you can't do this." But old Basil just overruled them. And so I remained on operational flying, and in fact became a test pilot at Boscombe Down in the middle of the war. And Basil had always said to me, "You know, when this is all over, they start sifting through people who are going to stay in the Air Force after the war, you're going to have problems. So if you have any problems, give me a call." By that time, he'd become the CNC Fighter Command after the war. And lo and behold, they said to me, "Yes, you can have a permanent commission. But it'll have to be in the admin and special duties branch." So I called Basil. And a few months later, I was installed back in the general duties branch again, with a full flying career ahead of me. As you probably know, he was shot down during the Battle of France in a Blenheim as a Blenheim squadron commander and made a really spectacular escape from the Germans. And of course, that event, you know, went with him. And so he was regarded as a fairly formidable character from all points of view.
What was his attitude towards the enemy?
Oh, he hated them. Absolutely hated them. In fact, he was one of the very few people, I think, that I met during the war who adopted such a sort of a positive, aggressive anti-German attitude.
How did he show it to you?
Oh, in his attitude and the way he spoke about them. And, of course, in his own way, even as the distinguished AOC of two group. He was flying continually on operations when he really had no right to do so.
Why did he, do you think that he adopted this attitude towards you getting back to operational flying?
Well, perhaps modesty prevents me from saying really why. I think he just recognised that, you know, he was a chap that wanted to and was keen to do so, and that therefore he should be allowed to do so.
Can you describe to me the incident in which you were wounded?
Yes. And in fact, I was flying with Johnny Johnson, you know, who at that time was my flight commander. And it was a bit of an anticlimax as I think about a few days before. I'd actually shot down a 190 over the Pas de Calais, and which, as I explained to you, you know, one at that time had only fleeting opportunities for that sort of thing, so I was feeling a bit cock-a-hoop. But we were back at Wittering. It was an evening when there was a cocktail party in the main. In fact, we were operating from a satellite at Wittering called Kingscliff. But there was a cocktail party in the main mess at Wittering, to which most of the squadron people were going to or had gone to. It was very quiet, nothing was happening. And I and a sergeant pilot, as my number two, had been left at readiness, the duty readiness Spitfire pair, when a plot appeared on the board of an enemy aircraft penetrating inland over Lincolnshire, flying in and out of layered cloud. We were scrambled to intercept it and were trying to find it in and out of the cloud, which time old Johnny had heard what was going on, so he and his number two, who hadn't left Wittering then, came screaming back, and they climbed into the Spitfires. So there were four of us trying to find this thing. I think they saw it pop out of cloud, but before they could do anything about it, it popped back into cloud. And then suddenly it popped out of the cloud straight in front of me. I swung round to attack it with guns firing, and a great succession of white phosphorus balls linked me into the mid-upper gun position. And I was within about 150 yards of it, and there was a most terrible crash. And my windscreen quarter panel and the hood had been hit and disintegrated, and all the bits came back into me. A whacking great bit of metal hit me in the chest, in the solar plexus, and knocked all my breath up. It smashed my goggles off and my oxygen mask, and took out my right eye. So it was a fair amount of mess. By this time, the the enemy aircraft had disappeared into cloud. And I was trying to, you know, pull myself together. There isn't really any pain under those circumstances. It's just intense shock. And in fact, the Spitfire really made the decision for me, because there was this enormous bang, and I had no idea what other parts of the aircraft had been hit as well. But fortunately, the rest of it was unscathed. And I suddenly found it was flying normally. The engine was running sweetly. So I pulled myself together. And I was still in cloud, I think, at this time. I couldn't jump up because the hood had been distorted over the top of my head. And as though all the perspex had disappeared, the frame was still and I couldn't have got out. So I just let down through the cloud and found an airfield right below me.
How quickly did you find that?
Oh, a few minutes. The worst problem, by that time, the shock had diminished. And I was, you know, more concerned with, you know, flying the aeroplane and getting it down. So I was distracted from my own state. But there was blood everywhere, and the problem was with the shattered hood. The blood was blowing from the right side of my face and my mouth into my left eye. And being cold, you know, it was congealing. So, you know, I had problems. I had a problem seeing anything. But anyway, eventually I managed to get the thing down all right. I got carted off to hospital.
What was this place where you'd landed?
It was North Luffenham, which wasn't far from Wittering.
North?
Luffenham.
And it was a Fokker Wolf that had shot you?
No, it was a Dornier 217. It was an armed reconnaissance aircraft.
Do you know the date?
25th of May, 1942.
What did you think of the medical attention you received?
Oh, that was marvellous. And in fact, landing at North Luffenham, you know, I was feeling a bit sorry for myself. There was a bit of relief then to find the aeroplane was on the ground. I put the undercarriage down. But then all sorts of lovely people came and, you know, lifted me out of the cockpit and comforted me. And I found myself in an ambulance with a nice young lady holding my hand, trundling off to hospital. And I think if there'd ever been a temptation to feel really sorry for myself, and there wasn't, but I was in Rossby Hospital in Lincolnshire at the time of the first 1,000 bomber raid on Cologne, and it was quite clear the hospital were preparing for something or the other. And of course, in the early hours of the following morning, an unbelievable number of people were being wheeled in, people that had been wounded,